Thank you. Stay
Thank
safe.
you.
Bye.
Now I'm going to go right next to our next guest. I want to apologize to her. We went a little bit over time, but I think that an article that she wrote on April 14th is a great way to kick off our interview with her, especially concerning the fact that it deals with this alliance building by the Turkish government. Before we get to that, let's introduce her properly. Irena Zuckerman is a human rights and national security attorney and analyst based in New York City. She has written extensively on geopolitics, security issues, and U.S. foreign policy for a variety of domestic international think tanks, such as the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies in Israel. Her writing is translated into multiple languages, and she has two new pieces that have come out in the last week, which we'd like to focus on today. One, on increased Iranian aggression in the time of the coronavirus, and two, the Sunni-Shia Islamist geopolitical bloc that is being built by the Erdogan government. Irena, welcome to the program.
Hi, Greg. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Of course. So you had this article that came out titled, Turkey is Building a Geopolitical Alliance Between Sunni and Shia Islamists. I'm sure you heard what Barak Bekdil had to say from within the region. Can you expand on his point about Turkey's intent for reaching out to both Sunni and Shia Islamists and what its ultimate end goal is?
Erdogan has a clear agenda. His agenda is neo-Ottoman, it's expansionist, and he is using both nationalist and religious appeal to literally any ally that he is capable of conjuring up to bring that goal about. Especially since he has alienated many state actors around the region, he's now reaching out to everyone else who remains, which includes Iran, which includes the Muslim Brotherhood, which includes governments in North Africa that are supportive or open to that agenda, or who have issues with their neighbors, whether or not they are directly Islamist or not.
Irina, I want to stop you for 1 second. I just would like to help our listeners define this political strategy. How do you define neo-Ottomanism?
Essentially, what Erdogan himself articulated through his analyst in the Anadolu agency not so long ago, he is building a defense line that is essentially restoring the borders of the Ottoman Empire to and possibly expanding beyond them. That's left unsaid, but is implied. It's implied through other actions. For instance, the activity of Turkish intelligence in Europe. As we know, the Ottoman Empire has never been able to progress much beyond the gates of Vienna. That is something that is now being, this idea of borders is now being erased by the proliferation of intelligence agents in Europe. Otherwise, he specifically said that from Qatar to Cyprus to Libya, Turkey considers all that territory its sphere of influence. It's important for its own defense.
So Erdogan is trying to reestablish. He's trying to reestablish Turkish Ottoman-esque influence in the areas which they had ruled for the better part of 1,000 years. Would that be an accurate interpretation?
Very much so. Very much so. Possibly well beyond that, actually.
And your reference to the gates of Vienna is the Battle of Vienna in 1463, I believe, where it was the high water mark of the Ottoman Empire, where they were defeated by a combined force of Austrian, Polish, and other European Christian forces. But moving beyond the ambition of Erdogan, I'd really like to focus on the increased Iranian aggression, which we're now seeing out of Tehran. Can you give us just a real quick synopsis of how the coronavirus is affecting Iran, and then pivot to how Iran is still carrying out extraterritorial, militant, and violent and terrorist activities beyond its borders?
Sure. For Iran, coronavirus has been a devastating disaster. A great number of high-level officials and clergy have fallen ill or actually passed away due to the illness. And the government, both the clergy, both the Ayatollahs and the politicians, have mishandled it tremendously. There are two reasons for that. One is a religious reason. There's been a pushback against science, and there's been a promotion of a concept called Islamic science, which has not been clearly defined at all, and seems to have very little to do with Islam and science in the common understanding of Muslim sciences and their peak during Enlightenment. So essentially, it's a religious / mystical / superstitious gathering of ideas that has no basis in medicine, and that is being heavily promoted by the religious class, by the Ayatollahs, by Ayatollah Khamenei, in contradiction to any norms. And the other concept is political, meaning there is this interest in undermining anything that comes from the West and making everything seem like a big conspiracy against Iran, and attacking any group, any NGO inside Iran that is looking to provide any sort of accurate information or anything that could be used as a from Iran's perspective, from the regime's perspective, as a pivot point for any dissent, any criticism of government action. So they've been cracking down on NGOs looking to provide accurate information about coronavirus prevention. They've been attacking any accurate information coming in as a Western conspiracy, and they've been saying that Iran doesn't need this, that the religion and Qom and the holy city of Qom are enough to sustain the country. They've been pushing people to visit Qom, which has been the epicenter of the epidemic, and to kiss religious shrines. And they've been promoting fake news, as we could say it, in terms of various unscientific ideas. Like one clergyman infamously promoted a lavender suppository as a response to coronavirus. That's one aspect of this issue. Second aspect is proselytization. Iran welcomed a number of Chinese Muslim scholars who brought the virus with them to the country. At the same time, it has been heavily proselytizing Shia and Islam in China and also around the world. Why are these very aggressive efforts in proselytization? It has been transferring the virus everywhere, and including a number of Muslim countries in the region which have Shia population. From Iran's perspective, this exportation of ideological revolution is far more important than any health consequences. As we have seen from Khomeini's own writings, the number one agenda for the Islamic Republic is exportation of revolutions abroad. It has not always been possible, but in later years, Iran has become much more aggressive and much more successful in ideological approach. So that's been, and all of that feeds into its larger geopolitical agenda and its overall aggression, because its aggression is focused as much on ideological land bridge building as an actual building of connections between Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and so forth.
Right. It's had this grand national project for the better part of the last 40 years, which it's implemented the most successfully, mm-hmm. one might argue, with Iraq and Syria in the last 10. But right now, mm-hmm. it's at the precipice of a divide between the coronavirus mm-hmm. inside the country and its desire to export its revolution and to cause havoc outside of the country. How have the two issues met with one another? How is it still able to fund its overseas ventures when the disaster is so hard at home?
Quite simply, by ignoring the crisis and not providing for the needs of the people at all. Arguably, Ayatollah Khamenei and others have access to funding. First of all, there's the discussion of a secret trust upwards of $200 billion that is located somewhere and that provides the Ayatollahs and others with seemingly infinite funding for their various ventures. No one knows where it is exactly, how it operates, or how much money is in there. They estimate around $200 billion. We don't know. Second, quite simply stealing and diverting humanitarian aid, investment funding that was supposed to be devoted to coronavirus. Secretary Pompeo spoke of about $1 billion in funding, public funding that was allocated towards pandemic prevention, that is quite simply stolen. It disappeared. At the same time, they accept humanitarian aid and from European countries, from Muslim countries, including Kuwait, UAE, and some others.
Have there been political consequences for the Ayatollahs because of this misbehavior?
Quite the opposite. In fact, there's been a propagandist push to lift sanctions inside Iran, which has been by Senator Dianne Feinstein in the United States, among others. And in Europe, European countries have actually worked with Iran to create mechanisms for circumventing U.S. sanctions and providing Iran with both direct humanitarian aid and financial aid. So the worse this is, the more Iran is using it towards its own advantage while using that funding to fund its various military adventures abroad, displaying new drones supposedly copied from the Israeli design, with which it uses to threaten Israelis, using Houthis to continuously attack Saudi Arabia, and increasing its aggression even outside the Middle East.
The Houthis being the rebel force in Yemen, and the Saudis having their campaign supporting the UN-backed government there of some of the Sunni forces. But we've done this analysis now for the past 10 minutes or so on how the Iranians are actually able to exploit the coronavirus at home to fund or to support or to act as a distraction with their overseas activities, which they've been doing for the better part of a few decades. Now, we haven't discussed a paragraph that you write in your article that I'm going to quote from of how America and its allies have been dealing with this. You give this analysis that I'd like to push on back a little bit, that you write in your article at the Begin Sadat Center from April 16th, that even if the cost of the lives of some leaders, Iran's attacks demonstrate its unabating fervor and dedication to expelling the U.S. from the region. The immediate exclusive focus on ISIS and unwillingness to treat the Iraqi government as a colony of Iran plays into Iran's hands. With the U.S. increasingly treated as an unwelcome guest in Iraq, while the U.S. government grasps at straws to defend its relationship with Baghdad, Iran is successfully weaponizing Kabul Sadr and using the cover of the coronavirus pandemic to push ahead. You then go on later in the article to point out that the U.S., while claiming an interest in rolling back Iranian influence, has put forth no vision of what that entails. It has already tacitly admitted that containment has failed, and despite tough talk from the White House, there appears to be no possibility of an internal coup to topple the regime from within. Rolling back Iranian ideology and outreach would require a detailed plan, close cooperation with major regional actors, ideological involvement, and dedication of financial, intelligence, and technological resources. And this is the crux of your argument. The U.S. is in no position to dedicate itself to such a project right now, and in any case is not willing to do so. You're right. The American government has flip-flopped on Iran from acting as a belligerent, almost going to war with Iran 4 months ago with the assassination of the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Al-Quds unit, now to their responses, which were going on last year around this time, not this time, but May and June, when the Iranians were blowing holes in Western-owned oil tankers. And it's largely abated its interest in Iran until President Trump this morning responding to an increase of Iranian fast in the Persian Gulf and its usage of those fast attacks to harass American shipping, Western shipping, and even an attempted takeover of a Chinese flagged vessel, and then the return of that vessel once the Iranians realized it was owned by China, where Trump says any further hostility by Iranian craft will lead to them being destroyed by the U.S. Navy. Now, that's a one-off response. It seems more out of anger than out of strategy. But how can you say that the U.S. doesn't have a strategy in Iran or dealing with the Iranians when only a few months ago it was assassinating the heads, not just head, the heads of its extraterritorial project in the Middle East? You know, can you give a little bit more clarification on your point there?
Absolutely. In fact, as I pointed out, that's precisely the issue, the fact that the U.S. has not been consistent. And in fact, its lack of strategy after the killing of Qasem Soleimani and some heads of the militias, it has not pursued a strategic response to Iran on all fronts. It killed a few people just to show that there was a red line in attacking and killing U.S. citizens, that it will not allow to be caused, and that was it. Since then, what have we seen? The U.S. pushed back somewhat against attacks on U.S. targets in Iraq, but it has not designated any Iraqi officials who facilitated those attacks and who facilitated Qasem Soleimani's attacks that led to his demise. We have seen the U.S. withdrawing, planned withdrawal, admittedly, from Iraqi bases under the pretext of the campaign against ISIS being successful. Yes. U.S. moved more forces from Syria to Iraq, but none of that has anything to do with the Iranian, with a coherent response to Iranian aggression. In Syria, it's Israel and other forces that are doing the brunt of the fight against Hezbollah and Iranian agents.
I do want to push back a little bit on what you just said, that the U.S. has not designated any Iraqi militias responsible for attacks against Americans.
It did designate
militias and officials, including Kataib Hezbollah and Ahmad al-Hamidawi, the head of the group which was responsible for launching mortar and rocket attacks against the American embassy in Baghdad and also other bases. And it has also designated leaders of different Syrian regime artifices and new sanctions on Hezbollah in Lebanon. So I think that it's fair to say that the U.S. has been tepid and lacking strategy, and it's a coherent, cohesive, systematic strategy in the region. But it has shown some glimmers of hope for being able to put together some responses when it comes to direct threats against American citizens. I think that the issue here is the U.S. being seen as a reliable ally in leading the anti-Iranian coordination that its regional allies are asking for. But to say that there is no strategy, I don't think that's a fair statement.
The strategy, as articulated by President Trump specifically, has been exclusively economic pressure and sanctions. That has not... Qasem Soleimani has been a designated terrorist for years, and that has not stopped him from roaming around Iraq and actually working with Iraqi politicians to smuggle oil necessary to sustain Iran's economy, which does not actually refine its oil, hasn't until very recently, and to rile up the public against the United States and to engage in all sorts of subversive activities until he was finally liquidated after the Iraq attack on that killed a U.S. citizen. So the same thing with everybody else, even all those other actors who have been designated and sanctioned and so forth, what are the real consequences for all of them? So there's most of them don't have funds in U.S. financial system. Most of them do not travel to the West. So in reality, it's essentially a fair game if the U.S. ever decides to knock them out, but most of the time, they don't do that. And these sanctions are not taken seriously either by our friends or by our allies. So as you've correctly pointed out, U.S. is seen as watching out for its own interests in a very limited and non-strategic way, and it's seen as letting the rest of the Middle East go to pieces. But the truth is we cannot separate our interests from what's going on elsewhere in the world entirely.
No, I agree with you for most of what you're saying on that. I just think that there has, from within the administration, to I'll let me put it this way. There have been the administration that have attempted to put a coherent, cohesive, systematic strategy to fight Shia influence and Iranian aggression in the region, but out of strategic focus, okay, there's strategy and then there's being able to focus on areas where strategy has been implemented has been quite weak. But but if we have the ability here to elaborate a little bit beyond the U.S.'s ability to carry out this strategy, I would also argue that outside of Israel, the ability for the U.S. to find reliable allies in the region to work with has also sort of vexed our ability to respond to Iranian aggression. I mean, the Saudis have lost the war in Yemen. The Emiratis pulled out. The Qataris are always stabbing us in the back. The Kuwaitis are only interested in their own self-preservation. The Iraqi government, or whichever iteration of the Iraqi government that the U.S. is supporting at the time, has not been able to bring its own solace. And even the Kurds have fought with each other internally, leading them to not be a reliable ally. Now, that's not to talk about the U.S.'s betrayal of Kurds in a few instances in the last few years, or the last 30 years. But it's been hard for the U.S. to find a reliable partner as well. There's one last comment is yours.
I actually, the issue is not that the allies are unreliable, because no ally is reliable 100% of the time. Everyone has their own interest, but that the U.S. has not been unwilling to respond to some of these issues. In Yemen, U.S. has not been much help against Hezbollah, against Iranian influence, with the exception of logistical support to Saudis. That's not sufficient. Overall, the U.S. has not shown any interest in working with the Saudis or anybody else on a long-term vision beyond financial sanctions. We have that on record. We don't even have any defense treaties with the Saudis, among others. We have vacillated between Qatar and the Saudis, despite a clear emerging of Qataris and Iran, which has split the GCC, rendering that form of strategy useless. And we have done nothing to further the plan for any sort of strategic alliance consisting of allies that are premised in common values and vision rather than old school premises, which didn't work to begin with. GCC was never functional because some of the actors were always with Iran.
So, Irina, I'm going to have to stop you there. Yeah, we're about before we have to end the program. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. And I hope that we can have you on soon.
Thank you so much. It was great. Thank you. I appreciate it.
This is Greg Roman here on WWDB 860 AM with the Middle East Forum Radio Hour, reporting live from with the hope that we'll be able to have you back on the program next week. I'd like to thank Marilyn Stern, our producer, Gary Gamble, our co-host, will be joining us hopefully again next week, and all of our listeners out there for joining us and on this program. Have a great day.